This is podcast number 188 for the Well-Educated Mother Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to share the introduction to Catch the Vision of the Well-Educated Heart. I know a big challenge a lot of people face is how to explain the well-educated heart to somebody else. I've wanted to put together a little introductory booklet for a while that you can hand out to your friends. The problem is, you cannot condense an entire landscape scene down to a couple of brushstrokes. So the best I hoped to do was to awaken an interest to learn more and to open their minds to the possibility that learning doesn't have to look like what we're used to. That introductory book is now ready to share, and you can find it on the Well-Educated Heart Reference Library page in the website or in our store. But for those of you who are connected to me through these podcasts, I'd like to share it with you here. So today, part one, and tomorrow I will share part two. This is the introduction to Catch the Vision of the Well-Educated Heart. Let us keep our children for our own during their earlier years. The world will have them long enough afterward. Lydia Sigourney. Joy is the serious business of heaven. C.S. Lewis. One day Bismarck was visiting Russia and looked out a window at Peterhof Palace. He noticed a sentry on duty in the middle of a lawn. He asked the Tsar why the man was there. The Tsar had no idea, so he asked his aide-de-camp, who also did not know. He sent for the officer in command. The officer in command did not know. Finally, the general over all the troops at Peterhof was sent for. "General, why is that soldier stationed in that isolated place?" "I beg leave to inform your majesty that it is in accordance with ancient custom." Bismarck inquired, "What was the origin of the custom?" The general replied, "I do not recollect at present." The Tsar issued the order, "Investigate and report the result." It took 3 days to discover the reason. The reason a sentry reported to the middle of the field every morning was because of an order put on the books 80 years before. Evidently, one spring morning, Catherine the Great had looked out on the lawn and saw the first flower blooming out of the frozen soil. She ordered a sentry to give watch and prevent anyone from picking the flower. 80 years later, a sentry still reported for duty. Traditions hang around for a long time when no one questions why. This is no less true for education. Researchers asked 365 people, "What is the purpose of education?" They received 365 unique answers. It would seem we are trying to find a one-size-fits-all system of education when we can't even agree on the why. Before we go any further, let me introduce myself. My name is Marlene Peterson. My husband, Brent, and I have raised 8 daughters and 1 son. I've always been restless where education's concerned, which is why we public schooled, homeschooled, private schooled, online schooled, charter schooled, correspondence schooled, unschooled, and did combinations of all of the above. You might say we're a success. All 9 of our children graduated from universities, with several earning advanced degrees. We're proud of their hard work. But I still felt like something was missing in their education. My search for what was missing began with a desire to understand God's purposes for education and His methods of learning. What I discovered is much grander, as His ways always are. Perhaps I'm merely providing answer number 366, but I have come to believe that the purpose of education is to prepare children to live lives of maximum joy. College and career are likely part of that path, but they are not the end destination. And the method can best be summed up in a phrase borrowed from Charlotte Mason's writings: true education is between a child's soul and God. I am not the founder of the Well-Educated Heart. I am simply a finder. It is not a curriculum. It's a way of learning where learning and life are not separated, where the spiritual is as important as the temporal, the seen and the unseen. I invite you to begin this journey of looking at education through new eyes and to catch the vision of possibilities by starting with a brief tour of the history of education as told in a book called Crusaders for Freedom. One of the most important of all the discoveries about children was that they had a right to an education. Of course, in one way, children had always had some kind of education. They had always been taught something, otherwise they wouldn't have lasted very long. Boys had learned to hunt and fish and swim and build fires and fight. Girls had learned to cook and sew and take care of babies. But when we say education, we mean something more than this. We mean schools and teachers and books and study and training and discipline. Of course, education, too, has been going on for a long time. But there are two things you can say about education during all the hundreds and hundreds of years from its beginnings in ancient Greece and Judea to just the other day. One is that very few people got any education at all. Poor people didn't need an education. What good would it do them to learn to read or write? Girls didn't need an education. Learning would be wasted on girls. No, education was for the rich and the great, or for those who were going to be rabbis or priests and who had to know how to read. And the second thing you can say about education is that mostly it wasn't much fun, neither for the children nor the teachers. Most teachers looked on children as little limbs of Satan, and most children looked on their teachers as their natural enemies. School was a kind of warfare between teachers and pupils, and no wonder. Drill, 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 Latin and Greek, memorize and repeat, and a rap on the knuckles if you got it wrong. So the world of children was pretty well divided between the great mass of children who didn't have a chance to learn anything and the handful of children who were made to learn things which they didn't enjoy and which weren't much use to them anyway. Now, if we are going to follow this discovery that children have a right to learn, we will be racing all over the world, Germany and Chile and Denmark and Massachusetts and China. It makes you dizzy just to think of it. Let us start in Germany, right in the center of Germany, in the ancient state of Thuringia, all hills and pine forests. And let us start with a young fellow named Friedrich Froebel. His father didn't think he was very bright, so it was his older brother who was sent to the university. While at the age of 16, Friedrich went to work as a forester in the thick Thuringian forests. Best thing that could have happened to him, too, for it meant that he learned to know nature. This was half of what he most needed to know in his lifetime. The other half was children. Some people seem born never to understand children. You'd think, to listen to them, that they had never been children themselves. All they can think of is, "Oh, stop that noise. Why don't you go out and play? Stop asking so many questions. Wash your hands. Comb your hair. Don't slouch. Sit up straight. Don't answer back. Don't speak until you are spoken to." And some people are born to understand children. Hans Christian Andersen, for example, who all his life thought and imagined things just the way children thought and imagined. Now, here is Friedrich Froebel, a German born at the very end of the American Revolution, who fell in love with nature and with children. Almost by accident, he got a chance to teach, and after that, he was never the same. "I was as pleased as a fish in water," he said, and for him, the water turned out to be the water of life. The first thing he did was to go off to the little Swiss village of Yverdon, where a teacher named Johann Pestalozzi was running a very curious kind of school. What was curious about it was that Pestalozzi really liked children, and that children really liked him. He liked teaching, and they liked learning. And now here was young Friedrich Froebel to help old Pestalozzi and to work out some ideas of his own, too. Between the two of them, the Swiss and the German, they made a revolution in education. It was the most peaceful revolution you ever heard of, but it was a revolution all the same. What Pestalozzi and Froebel said was really very simple. Children are people too. Children have rights. Let them learn naturally, not by having things hammered into them. Let them talk if they want to. No silence in the classroom or standing in the corner because they talked out of turn. Let them learn because they enjoy learning. No punishments because they don't know their lessons. Let them work things out for themselves, with their minds and with their hands. Let them learn to use scissors and needle, hammer and saw. Take them out into the country and let them see how flowers and trees grow, and how the birds build their nests, and how the fish dart under the rocks in the streams. Out of all this came a wonderful invention. It was Froebel's invention. Froebel called it a kindergarten. The kindergarten was just what its name says, a children's garden, a garden where each child would have his own piece of land to take care of. He could plant flowers and vegetables, water them, pull up the weeds, keep his garden tidy and beautiful. And he would learn lessons directly from nature. In the winter time, when he wasn't out in his garden, he could learn to draw flowers and trees, or to cut out pictures of animals and birds, and then to spell their names and learn about their habits. Learning would be made into a game where teachers and children played together. The kindergarten caught on, and soon everybody was talking about it. Soon visitors came flooding down to the little town of Blankenburg to see Herr Froebel's kindergarten. They saw that the children were healthy and happy, and that they were learning faster than at old-fashioned schools. Other teachers started teaching by the new kindergarten method, and soon the fame of the kindergarten went all over the world. A new idea in education. But aren't new ideas dangerous? Yes, indeed they are. So one day Friedrich Froebel read in the paper that the government had put a stop to all kindergartens. Surely that was a mistake. Why should the government be afraid of little children playing in their gardens? But it wasn't a mistake at all. The government really meant it. After all, they said, if you start with new ideas in school, who knows where you will end? Why, people might get in the habit of having new ideas, and nothing could be more dangerous than that. So let's stop all new ideas before they really get started. Ah, but the government was too late. The kindergarten idea was already started. Ideas are like wind. They blow around the world. There's no telling where they will go or who will breathe them into his lungs. Over in America, Bronson Alcott felt the winds of new ideas about children and education blowing on his cheek and filling his lungs. You know Bronson Alcott. You may not think that you know him, but you do, all right. He is the father of the Little Women, the father of Joe and Beth and Amy and Meg, and everybody in the world knows them. Did you think they weren't real people, or that their father wasn't a real father? He was real, all right, Bronson Alcott. He was one of the kindest and gentlest men you ever heard of. Only a girl who had grown up in a happy household could have written Little Women. But what an odd man he was, Mr. Alcott, absent-minded and simple-minded. He always seemed to be thinking of something else far away. You couldn't trust him with any money, because he would give it away to anybody who asked for it or needed it, and that was hard on his wife and children because they needed it too. You couldn't trust him to take care of himself either. Once, when a mob had gathered to rescue a runaway slave, and the soldiers stood at the courthouse door with their bayonets pointed, Mr. Alcott just walked up the steps and pushed the bayonets aside with his umbrella and said, "Why are we not within?" and went in. He believed that everything should be simple, really simple, just plain living and high thinking. And when he said plain living, you have no idea how plain could be. He set up a little community in a farmhouse that he called Fruitlands, not far from Boston, and everybody there lived plainly. Whether they went in for high thinking is another matter. But Bronson Alcott was not such a simpleton as you might think. After all, everybody respected him, even men like Theodore Parker and Ralph Waldo Emerson. In some ways, he was more sensible than almost anyone else. He didn't take things for granted, but worked them out for himself. He didn't take for granted that everything had already been thought of, but was quite sure that some new ideas were just as good as old ones, and maybe better. He wouldn't accept the notion that all men are naturally bad. On the contrary, he thought that all men were naturally good, and that if you trusted them and were fair to them, they would not disappoint you. And all that went for children, too. Just about the time Friedrich Froebel was opening his kindergarten over in Blankenburg, Bronson Alcott started the same kind of school in Boston. It was called the Temple School, because it was held in a room in the old Masonic temple. What a school this temple was! There had never been anything quite like it in America before. It didn't even look like a schoolroom. Pictures up on the walls and statues of gods and goddesses from Greek myths along the floor, and curtains at the windows, and chairs around in a circle instead of stiff desks lined up like an army. And it didn't sound like a schoolroom either. All the old ways of teaching were wrong, said Mr. Alcott. Let's wipe the slate clean and start over again. Children were naturally good, not bad. Just trust them to be good, and they would. Then away with all the punishments, away with the sharp voice and standing in corners with the ruler and the whip. Well, not quite all punishments. If a child was naughty, Mr. Alcott made him punish the teacher, and that, you may believe, made the child ashamed. Learning was natural as walking or swimming, so don't make a chore of it, just let it come naturally. No drill, no memorizing, no drudgery. Instead, conversations and songs and stories, not just from the teacher, but from the children too. And just as in Froebel School, the children were to learn with their hands as well as their heads. There was to be picture drawing and modeling in clay and working with wood and with cloth, cutting and sewing and painting. And when the weather was good, walks in the park studying nature at first hand. It was all too good to be true, and, of course, it couldn't last. It wasn't the government, as over in Thuringia, that closed down Mr. Alcott's temple school, but it was much the same thing. It was people who said, "This will never do. Imagine education being fun." So they took their children out of Mr. Alcott's school and sent them to schools where they would really learn something, like how to spell anti-disestablishmentarianism, or to say amo, amas, amat, and where they would be rapped over the knuckles if they got it wrong. Bronson Alcott wasn't the only man in Boston who was thinking about children and about education, any more than Friedrich Froebel was the only man in Thuringia who was trying to do something for children. There was one big difference between Boston and Thuringia, however, and that was that in Boston, the government was on the side of the children and of education. Boston had such a long tradition of education that some people think Boston invented it. If Pittsburgh is the steel city and Detroit is the automobile city, Boston is certainly the education city. For 300 years now, Boston has manufactured and exported brains the way other cities manufacture and export automobiles or steel. It all started when Boston itself started, back in the 1630s. Here is how one of the fathers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony tells it. After God had carried us safe to New England, and we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present minister shall lie in the dust. Almost the first thing the Puritans did when they came to Boston was to set up a school, and the very next year they set up a college and named it after John Harvard, who left it his library and a bit of money. That's one way to be immortal. But the Puritan fathers knew what nobody much in England or France seemed to understand, that you can't really build a roof before you have the foundations and the walls. And you can't have a learned ministry unless you start by teaching children their ABCs and a bit more. So, in 1647, the Puritans passed a law that every town in the colony had to keep a school for its children, so that learning may not be buried in the graves of our fathers. Well, that's not so much, you say, and perhaps not by your standards. But nobody else had thought of it. It was the first law of its kind anywhere in the world. That's much. What a love of learning in the Bay Colony. Yes, and in the other New England colonies, too. Look over New England, and what you see is schools, academies, colleges. Why, when the Revolution broke out, New England had more colleges than Old England, and New England was probably the only region in the world where almost everybody could read the Bible and the newspapers, and where almost everybody could speak up in public meeting and make sense. But somehow, after the Revolution, things got bogged down. Education went backward instead of forward. The towns began to feel poor and stopped supporting their schools. They crowded their children into miserable ramshackle buildings, cold in the winter, hot in the summer, with leaky roofs and drafty windows, and for playgrounds, only a muddy yard. When they hired teachers, they got the cheapest they could find, old women who had no other way to stay out of the poorhouse, or down-and-out men who knew nothing about teaching and cared less. Worst of all, the towns didn't even enforce the laws about going to school. Thousands of little boys and girls who should have been at school were working 10 or 12 hours a day in factories instead. What had happened to education in New England? That's what Horace Mann asked himself. What has happened? But he asked another question, too. What are you going to do about it? Meet Horace Mann. He is another of those people who believed in children, but he was not in the least like Bronson Alcott. He was as tough as an oak tree and as resolute as a ship driving through the waves. A tall, slender man with an immense forehead and burning eyes, when he made up his mind to something, he did it. At the age of 19, he made up his mind to go to college. He had been a working man since he was 10, and he learned enough in 6 months to get into the sophomore class at Brown University. And then, in time, he graduated at the head of his class. He made up his mind to marry the daughter of the president of his college, and he did that, too. He made up his mind to study law and go into politics, and before he was through, he was a senator down in Washington. But all of these things counted for nothing when he made up his mind to save the schools of his state of Massachusetts. When he was through, you wouldn't have recognized them as the same schools. For that matter, you would hardly have recognized Massachusetts as the same state. And before he was through, he had changed not only the schools of Massachusetts, but of the whole United States and of many other countries in the world as well. He was that kind of man, the kind who knows what has to be done and then drives toward it. Nothing could stop him. Nothing could discourage him. Nothing could turn him aside. Nothing could frighten him. He was like a general commanding an army, firm and patient and brave and determined to win at whatever cost. He was the George Washington of American education. In 1837, Horace Mann got a new job. The state of Massachusetts had finally decided that something ought to be done about its schools, but just what ought to be done, nobody seemed to know. So they set up a board of education, and the governor asked Horace Mann to be in charge of it. The pay? Very poor. The duties? Well, everything anybody could think of. Not much of a job for one of the leading lawyers of the state. Not much of a job for a state senator. But Mr. Mann didn't hesitate for a moment. "Be ashamed to die," he once said, "until you have won some victory for humanity." Here was his chance to win a victory for humanity. For humanity, not just for the children. Horace Mann was interested in children, all right, but he was interested in them chiefly because they were going to grow up and be citizens and voters. How could they be good citizens or good voters if they didn't have a proper education? Horace Mann saw what Thomas Jefferson had seen 50 years earlier, that the United States was trying a new experiment in the world, and that education was part of it. It was an experiment in self-government. Everywhere else in the world, people were ruled by emperors and kings, by generals and admirals, or by the rich and the well-born. Education wasn't so important in these countries. Just educate the kings and the generals and the rich, and the rest of mankind wouldn't need education. But in America, it was the people who were the rulers. They were expected to run all their affairs. They were expected to elect governors and judges and presidents. They were even expected to be governors and judges and presidents. Everybody took for granted that the rulers in the old world had an education, the kings and lords and, Why not take for granted that the rulers in the New World should have an education too? The farmers and working men and shopkeepers. Education for citizens. That's what Horace Mann was thinking about day and night. Education so democracy would work. Education so the republic would survive. After all, as he wrote, the children of this people will soon possess the rights of men, whether they possess the character of men or not. That is, they would grow up to vote and to hold office, even if they didn't have any education. So better see to it that they did have an education. With Horace Mann at the helm, things really got going. Back and forth across the state from Boston to the Berkshires, he went, stopping at all the cities and the country villages too, inspecting the schools, explaining to the people why it was to their advantage to have better schools. He persuaded the towns to vote more money for teachers. He saw to it that the schools were neat and clean and well heated and well run. He got high schools going in all parts of the state. He had been born in a town that took the name of Franklin because old Benjamin Franklin had given it a library, and when he was a boy he had read just about every book in that library. Now he set up libraries in the schools so other children could have the chance that had meant so much to him. Then he had a brilliant idea. One reason so much of the teaching was so bad was that most of the town fathers who hired the teachers took for granted that anybody could teach. All you needed was someone who knew just a little more than the children. And as for knowing how to teach, why, there was no trick to it. Just beat it into them. But Horace Mann had studied under some of these teachers, and he knew how silly that theory was. You had to learn how to teach just as you had to learn how to do everything else, cook or make furniture or practice law. So he set up schools to train teachers, the first in America. He called them normal schools, which was the French name for them, but pretty silly when you come to think of it, so we just call them teachers' colleges. So much for Massachusetts, then. Things were looking up there, but Horace Mann was thinking of more than his own state, of more even than New England. He was thinking of the children of the whole country, children who would grow up to be voters and who would be running the country in another 15 or 20 years. How to reach them? Not everybody could hear Mr. Mann when he talked, but everybody could read what he wrote. So each year he sat down at his desk in Boston and wrote out a report on education. Each report was really a book, and it wasn't just a report on what he had done during the year. It was far more than that. It was a discussion of what ought to be done about education everywhere. Never had there been such a discussion of schools and of education as in Horace Mann's reports. 12 of them before he was through. What should schools teach? How should they be run? How do you get teachers and train them for teaching? How can schools help make good citizens? How do American schools compare with French and German and English schools? These were the things Mr. Mann wrote about in his reports. Everybody read them. Everybody who counted anyway. And almost everybody who read them sat down and wrote Mr. Mann a letter. Why, they had to put on an extra postman every time Mr. Mann sent out one of his reports. Here is what our schools are like in Ohio, they wrote. Or, here is our problem in Virginia. Or, how can we get the people of our town interested in their schools? Or, how do you get a library started? And so many of them ended, won't you come out and tell us what to do? It was not only in America that men and women read Horace Mann's reports. They read them all over the world. They still do. One day there was a knock on the door of Mr. Mann's house in East Newton, just outside Boston. When Mrs. Mann opened the door, there was a swarthy man with black hair and a black mustache. His name, he said, was Domingo Sarmiento, and he had come over from England just to talk with Mr. Mann. From England? With that accent? Well, really from Chile. From Chile? Well, really from the Argentine, but it was all very complicated. Anyway, he had read Mr. Mann's reports over in England, and he couldn't go home until he had seen him. That was the beginning of one of the important friendships in history. For Domingo Sarmiento was no ordinary man. He was the Thomas Jefferson of his country, of the great country at the other end of the South American continent named Argentina. Domingo Sarmiento was born in the Argentine in the little country village of San Juan, nestling in the foothills of the snow-capped Andes. He was a village boy, just like 100,000 other village boys and 100,000 other little villages where nothing ever happened except the church bells ringing for early mass, or the winds blowing dust in from the pampas, or the wild cowboys riding into town and turning everything topsy-turvy. But something happened to him. Maybe it was reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, in Spanish, of course, and wondering if he couldn't grow up to be like Mr. Franklin. I felt I was Franklin, and why not? I was as poor as he, studied as hard as he, and managed to follow in his footsteps, so said young Domingo. He didn't really follow in Franklin's footsteps as much as in Jefferson's, but then Jefferson didn't write an autobiography, so Domingo didn't know about him, not until much later on, anyway. What an ardent young man he was. He started imitating Franklin by getting himself involved in a revolution. That was easy in the Argentine. There was almost always a dictator in power in Buenos Aires, and almost always a number of little local dictators lording it over some province or other, and almost always some kind of revolution. The difference between Franklin's revolution and Sarmiento's is that Franklin won and Sarmiento lost. Quite a difference. The wonder is they didn't put young Sarmiento up against a stone wall and shoot him. Instead, they told him to get out of the country, over the Andes and into Chile. That's the best for you. Good riddance. It was just about the best thing that ever happened to Domingo Sarmiento, for it was in Chile that Señor Sarmiento really found his life work, a work that turned out to be very much like Horace Mann's life work. He started to teach. He wrote books on teaching. He set up a school for teachers. Pretty soon the government of Chile, which was much more sensible than the government in the Argentine, made him Minister of Education, much the same kind of job that Horace Mann took on. Señor Sarmiento knew that the Europe of his day was swirling with new educational ideas, so off he went to Europe to learn for himself. Switzerland, Germany, France, talking with people like Froebel and with that odd man who had invented the normal school named Victor Cousin. Then, before he went home, Sarmiento crossed the channel to England to see if he could learn anything there. The most important thing that happened to him in England was that he read Horace Mann's report on education. He was so excited that he went to Boston just to see Mr. Mann. You don't usually get so excited about a book that you go clear across an ocean just to talk to the author. But then you aren't Domingo Sarmiento either. In a way, the United States went to Sarmiento's head, and he never got over it. He went back to Chile to carry through many of the reforms he had seen abroad, and he did, too. Then there was another turn of the wheel of fortune in the Argentine, and now they wanted the famous Sarmiento back home. So there he was, Minister of Education, with power to do almost all the things he wanted to do. But it wasn't easy. The Argentine was so far behind, everything had to be done from the ground up. In no time at all, Sarmiento had built hundreds of new schools and trained teachers and set up libraries and opened up colleges. It was a real revolution. And as for Sarmiento, he was so successful that they wouldn't leave him alone but took him away from his schools and sent him back to the United States as ambassador. Horace Mann was dead now, but there were others carrying on his great work, and Ambassador Sarmiento spent most of his time learning about American schools. He saw how the new states in the American West started off with schools and colleges, and he saw how all the millions of immigrants pouring in from Europe were made into Americans by the American schools. That was what the Argentine needed, schools and colleges in the new states out on the pampas, and millions of immigrants who would be made into Argentinians. And then there was still another spin of the wheel of fortune, and, well, remember what we said about Sarmiento being like Thomas Jefferson? Now he found himself president of the Argentine, just as Jefferson was president of the United States. He thought of all that Horace Mann had done, and he thought of all that Jefferson had done, and he knew that this was his chance to make the Argentine the United States of South America. He did many things as president, but mostly he was an educator president. Mostly he did things for the children and the young people so that the Argentine could catch up with the countries of the old world and with the United States. Now over to Denmark, on the other side of the world from the Argentine. Poor little Denmark. Somehow she had got mixed up in the war that raged all over Europe and on the losing side. Here she is in 1815, at the end of her tether. Her territory is torn in two, and what is left is almost too small to bother with. Her capital has been bombarded. Her treasury is empty. Her people are poor, and what is worse, they are in despair. How to save Denmark from going under? That was what the young clergyman Nicholas Sven Grundtvig asked himself. And as nobody else had an answer, he found one. As nobody else seemed ready to save Denmark, he undertook to do it himself, or at least to call on the Danish people to do it themselves. When you call on people to do things, they usually respond. But first, there has to be someone with the vision to see what needs to be done. Save Denmark by religion. And Pastor Grundtvig started a religious revival, speaking to his countrymen in warm, simple language that they could understand, and calling them back to the churches. Save Denmark by remembering its glorious past. After all, it had a longer history than almost any other country, and historian Grundtvig wrote its histories in words which everybody could read, and which stirred every Dane with pride in his country's history. Save Denmark by telling the story of its myths and the wonderful story of Norse mythology, of gods like Odin and Thor and Freya. You know them well because they gave us the names of our days, Odin's Day or Wednesday, Thor's Day or Thursday, Freya's Day or Friday. Save Denmark by songs and music, and poet Grundtvig, the greatest of all Danish poets, wrote lovely and thrilling songs that everybody could sing and that sang themselves into the hearts of the people. Above all, save Denmark by education. What do you mean by education? Denmark already had schools, and all Danish children were supposed to go to them and learn their letters. What more do you need than that? A great deal more, said Schoolmaster Grundtvig. A great deal more. Your schools are all very well for teaching the ABCs and the multiplication tables and such matters, but these are not enough. They are all right to begin with, but we must do more than begin. We must go on and on. Education isn't something that stops when you are 10 or 12 years old. Education is for life. You see, Grundtvig was saying much the same thing that Friedrich Froebel was saying in Germany, and Bronson Alcott in Boston, and Domingo Sarmiento in Chile, and the Argentine. Old-fashioned education wasn't enough. But Grundtvig came up with a really new idea. There aren't many new ideas in history, so pay attention to this one. Education didn't need to end when you had finished school. You could go back and start again in a different kind of school. He called it the Folk High School. Not at all like the high schools you know, or like any schools that you know. Really, more like the summer camps that some churches run nowadays. The Folk High School was meant for youngsters of 17 or 18, and pretty soon they would marry and settle down for life on some farm or in some village, and that would be the end of them. Catch them while they are still young and full of life and hope, said Grundtvig. Give them something to think about, these peasant boys and girls who might otherwise turn into drudges. Bring them together in the winter months when work on the farm was slack, and let them study together and work together and sing and play together. Let them read the Bible for themselves and discuss it among themselves. Tell them stories from Danish history and from Norse mythology, and let them get interested in the past. Teach them how to read music and get in the habit of singing. What a comfort that would be in the years ahead. And teach them practical things, too. Teach the boys up-to-date methods of farming. Teach the girls how to cook and bake and sew and keep house. Give them the habits of thinking and talking and reading and a sense of self-respect. Open their eyes to the world about them. open their minds to the world of learning, open their hearts to the world of their fellow men. Let them come to know the richness of life. What an exciting idea. What an exciting program. But Bishop Grundtvig, yes, he was a bishop now, was far too busy to carry it out himself. He let his young friend Christian Kuld do that. Grundtvig was a remarkable man, perhaps the most remarkable man Denmark ever produced. But Christian Kuld was pretty remarkable too. He was the son of a shoemaker, and his father wanted him to be a shoemaker too, but that didn't work at all. He was so clumsy that he couldn't even hammer a nail into a shoe without hitting his fingers, and he spoiled enough leather to make shoes for a whole army, anyway, a Danish army. No, what Christian wanted was to be a teacher, never anything but that. He began to teach when he was only 15, and he did well enough, too, but he couldn't get a regular teaching job because the men who sat in big offices back in the capital and ran all the schools said that he was too much of a dreamer. He might lead the young people astray, just like Friedrich Froebel in his kindergartens. It certainly is comforting the way all the men who sit in big offices with titles in front of their names and gold braid on their uniforms worry about children being led astray. True enough, Christian Kuld did have a lot of odd ideas. Curiously, they were almost the same ideas that Froebel had in Germany, and that Bronson Alcott had in Massachusetts, and that other people had all over the world. So maybe they weren't so odd after all. Why should education be a matter of learning things by heart? Really, the heart didn't have much to do with it. It was more like learning by machine. Why should children hate school? Why should the teacher and the pupils be at war with each other? Why not make schools pleasant by playing games and telling stories and helping with the work, just as mothers did with their children at home? Anyway, you can see why those officials in the capital wouldn't give Christian Kuld the job. Then young Christian got a chance to go to Syria as a tutor. Imagine way out there, almost at the other end of the world. And off he went. After a while, he got tired of that, just as you would, and wanted to go home again. He had money enough to get on a boat to Italy, and there he bought himself a little go-kart and piled all his belongings into it and started to walk back home to Denmark. He did it, too, over mountains and across rushing rivers and along valleys and through busy towns, hundreds and hundreds of miles across Austria and Germany to Denmark. My, how glad he was to get home again. When he got home, he read about Grundtvig's idea for folk high schools. Just the thing, he thought, just what he had always wanted to do. So he hurried off to talk with the great man and to get his blessing, which Grundtvig was quite ready to give. Then he borrowed some money and rented a house in the little town of Riesling. And in 1850, smack in the middle of the century, he opened the first Danish folk high school. At first, only one student turned up. "Please, God," Kuld prayed, "let there be at least three so I can go on with it." And on opening day, 15 more came piling in, and his high school was launched, and with it one of the great experiments in the history of education. That's the way most things start. One man with an idea and with courage. Soon folk high schools were popping up all over Denmark. Every young man and woman in the country, it seemed, wanted to go to the folk high school. Almost overnight, the Danish peasant was changed. He stopped being a peasant and became a citizen. He got interested in religion, in schools, and in politics. He became a better farmer, in time the best farmer in the world, and a better working man, too, because he was a better man. Within a few years, Denmark had come to life. Denmark had had a revolution. How to save Denmark? Why, Denmark was saved. Denmark was prosperous. Denmark was democratic. Denmark had the best schools anywhere. Feel sorry for Denmark? Nonsense. Everybody envied Denmark. And the folk high school? It spread to Norway and Sweden and Finland and Germany, and to many other countries in Europe. It spread even to Asia. Bye-bye. See you next time.